I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source at the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is about the legal black hole of Guantanamo, the U.S. detention center that the U.S. Supreme Court says was run illegally, the offshore holding pen that became a breeding ground for torture, the prison that the next president, whoever it is, will close. So then how much more do we want to know or need to know about how and why Guantanamo happened? If war crimes were committed there, punishable as federal offenses, as Supreme Court Justice Kennedy wrote, who will prosecute them? Who will pay? How does the country clear its conscience and its name? Our conversation is with Philippe Sands, an English barrister who has taught law in America, too. He tracked an amazing range of good guys and bad guys in the Guantanamo story. Amazingly, they talked to him, too, for a book that leaves you gasping. Torture Team, subtitled Rumsfeld's Memo and the Betrayal of American Values. Philippe Sands, you've written, in addition to a whodunit, fascinating kind of repertorial reconstruction of the Guantanamo story. You've written, really, a war crimes indictment against key Bush lawyers. You encouraged by the Supreme Court majority that said not only Geneva does apply, always did apply to all the detainees, but that war crimes have been committed. The question is, now what?
The judgment of the Supreme Court at the end of June 2006 in the case of Hamdan versus Rumsfeld was absolutely crucial to the story that I tell, because in that judgment, the majority concluded that, contrary to the position argued by the Bush administration, common Article 3 of Geneva applied to all the detainees at Guantanamo, which means all of the detainees at Guantanamo are entitled, as a matter of law, not to be subject to cruelty or outrages or torture. And as Justice Anthony Kennedy pointed out in his separate opinion, the judgment necessarily opens the door to war crimes. In other words, the failure to meet the standards of Common Article 3 in the treatment of detainee 063, Mohammed al-Qahtani, amounted either to outrages against human dignity or cruelty or perhaps even, as some would say, torture. So war crimes were committed. What happens next? Well, one hears many voices saying, we need to look to the future, we need to move on, the past is the past, it doesn't happen anymore, let's forget about it. But of course, that's not the position the United States has taken in other parts of the world in relation to the violations of international criminal laws by others. And I think that the do-nothing option is not an option, because experience tells us that these issues fester, they create resentments, and they come back to haunt in the most unlikely places. And perhaps most practically, if the United States doesn't do anything to get its house in order, others will, and the possibility of war crimes investigations or even prosecutions, as I've described, cannot be excluded. So the US has to do something, and there are a number of options. The US can carry out investigations and try to sort out what the facts are. The US can go down the route that others have, truth and reconciliation. Or the US can appoint a special prosecutor or find other ways of investigating by reference to the criminal law. What I think I'd say by way of summary is doing nothing is not an option. There are various options available, and I think it's got to be a matter first and foremost for the US to decide which of those routes it takes.
There's also the Pinochet problem of people who could be charged with war crimes getting picked up in London or Paris or Bogota, for that matter. Should Jim Haines, should Donald Rumsfeld, should Alberto Gonzalez, if you were their lawyer, should they travel abroad?
Well, the Pinochet problem is very real. What the Pinochet problem is also very simple. Where an act of torture has occurred, under the 1984 Convention Against Torture, any person who is responsible for that torture, any person who is complicit or has participated, is at risk of criminal investigation or prosecution. What that means is that anyone who's associated with the story in a real and direct way is at risk in any part of the world to which the convention applies, which is most of the world, of what one might call the tap on the shoulder. I think there's a real issue for those who were involved, and I think that they will be traveling with care. You know, I raised this question directly with President Carter. I interviewed him a few months ago at the Hay Literary Festival in Wales. He's written extensively on the need to avoid impunity. He described to me how he had avoided any suggestion of impunity when he was a sort of special envoy type of person in the Yugoslav context. He has spoken out very loudly against President Bush's policy of torture. And I put to him the possibility that President Bush himself could be at risk. President Carter raised the issue of Pinochet, and pausing, he said to me in an audience of a couple of thousand people, "You know, what I hope for my president is that he's able to live in secure retirement in our country." In other words, what the audience understood, what I understood, was that President Carter was sending a pretty clear signal, as I think many others will send, that travel outside the United States may be a hazardous activity for some people.
I want to come back to this question of what the United States will do morally, politically, to get beyond this history. But let's come back to that. Walk us through the investigations themselves, the interrogations of this man, Al-Qahtani. Al-Qahtani was the target of all these new interrogation techniques. The government called him the 20th hijacker. He'd been captured in Afghanistan just a few months after 9/11. He'd been in detention for a full year before the new interrogation came down upon him. First of all, what would you have done with him? Who was he? Who was he really? What did he know?
Well, I don't know who he really is or who what he knew. Of course, I didn't have an opportunity to meet with him. I met with his attorney, and I spoke with her, and I write about that in the book. He was taken to he was captured in Afghanistan, I think, in late November 2001, taken to Guantanamo at the end of January 2002, subjected to the normal techniques of U.S. interrogation. That's to say, rapport building. He had FBI interrogations, he had military interrogations, and rapport building, building up a relationship, building up a degree of confidence in the belief that that will encourage information to come out. It didn't produce startling information. And in June 2002, a decision was taken, as I believe on high, the upper echelons of the Pentagon, to move to a regime of more aggressive interrogation, not consistent either with the Geneva Conventions or with the U.S. Manual of Military Law, the U.S. Army Field Manual. And what they did was initially subject him to very extended periods of solitary confinement, I think starting on August the 8th, 2002. Then on November the 23rd, 2002, they began to use 15 techniques of interrogation on him. They interrogated him continuously for periods of 20 hours. They gave him 4 hours off, but he wasn't, I think, properly allowed to sleep during those 4 hours because they used loud noise and white noise to disrupt his sleep patterns. They subjected him to the presence of dogs. They force-groomed him. They fed him intravenously. They subjected him to extremes of a hot temperature and cold temperature to the point that in early December 2002, he was in fact hospitalized for hypothermia. Remember, this is Cuba, not a cold country. You can begin to imagine what was being done. Throughout this entire process, astonishingly, a medical person was in attendance, presumably to keep him in a state fit for interrogation. He was subjected continuously to this abusive stuff for a period of 54 days until it was stopped by Donald Rumsfeld at the instance of a number of people who strongly opposed these techniques.
But I read all that wondering, what would you have done? Do you think he could have been turned? The new interrogation began at a point when the dimensions of the threat were still not clear. Another attack from Al-Qaeda might have been possible. What would have worked, if anything, from this witness?
I mean, of course, I'm not an interrogator. I spoke to numerous people who are interrogators. I spoke and I describe in the book my conversation with the head of Al-Qahtani's exploitation team, as it's called, up at the Defense Intelligence Agency in Washington, D.C., and from him, I pretty much picked up. They didn't get anything at all out of Al-Qahtani using the aggressive techniques of coercive interrogation, as they call them. What would I have done? Well, I must say I was pretty persuaded by Mike Gellis. Mike Gellis is a clinical psychologist. He was down at Guantanamo. He refused to participate in the aggressive techniques of interrogation, but he talked me through the use of rapport building and the classical techniques and described to me how, in his direct experience, this tended to work better than anything other. I mean, he was strongly opposed to aggression, and he thought if they could produce results, assuming he had information, and I think a lot of people thought actually he didn't have any information, then rapport building was the most likely technique that would work.
I pushed the question just because reading the interrogation record, it doesn't sound at all to me as a reader that they wanted information or expected to get it. It seemed to me they might have been trying to drive him crazy, you know, dropping water on him, all these reinforcing means of humiliation. They might have been trying to teach him a lesson or maybe just vent their own anger, but I can't imagine that they really thought they were going to get stuff a year later from this method.
Well, one of the things that struck me very forcefully, as I describe in the book, is the way in which seasoned interrogators basically tell you that interrogation processes take time, that generally aggressive interrogation of the kind that is being used on Al-Qahtani does not work at all. If there is an argument for saying it does work, and that even those who told me this said they were strongly opposed to it, it's literally at the moment of capture. It is at the moment that someone is caught in the heat of the battlefield. At that point, the person is discombobulated, disorientated, terrified at that very moment, but at no other time. Aggressive interrogation may work, although the people who spoke to me, to a man and a woman, said that they would even then oppose it. But you're right. Waiting a year after capture and then subjecting him to this type of interrogation was bound to be a completely useless exercise, as indeed it was. That raises the question, why was it done?
Exactly.
Well,
exactly.
I mean, there are a number
of real reasons.
Why did this really happen? Well, it may be that the decision makers who pushed this line at the upper echelons of the administration believed this might work. If they did believe that, they didn't do their homework and they weren't acting on the basis of legal advice or advice from interrogators on works. Or it might be that there were other reasons, that there was some sort of desire by the administration, recognizing the cultural and ethnic and religious backgrounds of the detainees they had, to pursue a particular type of interrogation on the belief, mistaken in my view and in the view of most other people who were involved, that these types of detainees would react only to violence. And I think there's some support for that, at least in the nature of the interrogation techniques
support
that were being
what?
Identified. Well, so for example,
For the notion that this was an ethnically targeted scheme?
Well, for the notion that the interrogation techniques were intended to break down, you know, this guy's soul and his spirit, and that they were designed particularly by reference to his ethnicity and his background. Let me give you an example. One of the techniques, on its face, doesn't look too bad. It's one of the Category 3 techniques, supposedly one of the worst, light shoving and poking. You and I might look at that and think, well, bit of light shoving and poking, what's the problem with that? Mike Gellis explained it to me graphically. Imagine light shoving and poking in this context. The detainee is a Muslim male. The detainee is naked. The detainee has a dog located immediately in his vicinity. The detainee has been force-groomed. The detainee has had pictures of 9/11 victims pasted all over his body. The victim has had threats to his family. And the victim is now placed on the floor in a prostrate position in which a semi-clad female straddles him and touches him in inappropriate places. That was what happened. And that was plainly, according to Mike Gellis, and I think it's plain that he's right, a very culturally specific form of interrogation.
Meaning it wouldn't have been done against...
Well, meaning that this particular form... I mean, you know, some, let's put it bluntly, some guys are not going to object to being in that sort of situation of physical proximity to a female where they are naked and where the female is virtually naked also. Hmm. But for a religious Muslim male, that is a deeply problematic, offensive position to be in. And those who designed the techniques of administration and applied them knew that. That is clear.
But again, to get information or just to insult the human being?
Well, I think the intention is that you break the person's spirit by so humiliating the individual that they lose a sense of who they are and in that context begin to talk. I mean, as I say, it strikes me as completely hopeless. Many of the interrogators that I spoke to said it was completely hopeless and it was bound to fail, and that in those circumstances, the old truism would come to pass. The person being interrogated is basically just going to tell the interrogators what they think they want the interrogators to hear so that the abuse stops. And that goes back a long way. You know, there's a rather interesting interview between John McCain and Dan Rather given in 1997, where Dan Rather makes exactly that point. There comes a moment where you feel so abused, you feel so humiliated, you so want it to stop that you basically will spend your time trying to work out what it is they want to hear, and you will give them what it is they want to hear. It just doesn't work.
Even before your interrogation narrative begins, it was less than 6 months after 9/11, President Bush decided that the Geneva Convention rules on torture would not apply to the detainees. In hindsight, that was the ballgame. How did he get away with it?
Well, he got away with it for a certain period. It was a very stupid decision. It was a decision taken in February 2002 on the basis of legal advice, on the basis of views adopted by, for example, his Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Doug Feith, to essentially adopt a decision which would mean that none of the detainees at Guantanamo, whether al-Qaeda or Taliban, would have any rights under the Geneva Conventions, and in particular Common Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which prohibits outrages, cruelty, and torture. And, of course, that opened the door to the removal of constraints on interrogation. I put it to Doug Feith, was that the intention? And he responded to me, as I recall, absolutely. That was plainly what was intended. So it was a conscious decision. It was taken early, and it was apparently and obviously taken off the back of a decision even by then that they wanted to take the gloves off on interrogation techniques and move to an abusive system.
It's a judgment that the Supreme Court, of course, has now very clearly overruled. I still wonder, how did it pass muster with the rest of us, with Congress, with the press, with the legal profession?
Well, at the time, the full decision was not made public. That was only released in June 2004, although there was information in relation to the decision on Geneva at about the time that it was taken, and I vaguely recall that decision. It didn't go through unopposed. The State Department, lawyers Will Taft and obviously his boss Colin Powell, wanted the decision to take a different path. They wanted the decision to be that Geneva would apply because they felt that as a practical matter, a decision to disapply Geneva, or at least to remove rights for detainees at Guantanamo in the war on terror, would come back to haunt the United States. Mm-hmm. You know, it's plain that the U.S. has got itself into this mess by embarking on a so-called war on terror. Having appropriated the language of war, they, of course, came four square into the rules of war, international humanitarian law, and in particular the Geneva Conventions. And so they had to find a way to get around those rules in order to promote and to prosecute the policies they wanted, including the removal of, in effect, all restraints on techniques of interrogation. It's a decision that's going to come back to haunt many of the people in the administration because, of course, it opened the door to the war crime situation that the Supreme Court and Justice Anthony Kennedy later identified.
I'm not thinking about them so much as about us. What was it in the culture? What was it in the legal profession that dropped our guard against torture? I mean, there's a tradition, as you write, going back to Abraham Lincoln, very, very clear in the law, clear in a certain swath of the military tradition, too, that this is a complete no-no. How did we let it happen?
It happened because the president and the Secretary of Defense were able to rely on advice from lawyers who were ideological and incompetent. This is not legal advice coming from the lawyers who actually know the subject matter. This is not lawyers who have spent years in the U.S. military or in the State Department arguing and promoting the United States' positions. This is a very small group of lawyers parachuted in, mostly from law schools, many of whom have no real practical experience in lawyering skills, who have a particular ideological bent, extending executive power, restricting the writ of international law, removing constraints on the US and presidential exercise of sovereignty. And what we now know happened is the lawyers who would have objected were cut out of the decision-making process, state and military, and the lawyers who decided, who advised, were in effect rubber-stamping a policy, and they were hand-chosen by reference to their ideological precepts.
I still haven't heard why we, in the mass, in the popular culture, softened up on torture.
I think that's a very, very complex question. I've thought about it a lot, and I've compared in my mind and in some of my writings the different of approach between the United Kingdom and the United States. I straddle the two countries. My wife is a New Yorker. My kids were born here. I spent an awful lot of time here. And I picked up very, very significant differences between the two communities, the UK and the US, in the period after September the 11th. And I happened to be in New York teaching at NYU Law School on September the 11th, so I'm acutely aware of what happened that day. I lived through it directly myself. The media went to sleep. It was astonishing. You couldn't get articles written as appeared in the British media already in January 2002 concerning what was going on, apparently, down at Guantanamo and the creation of a legal black hole. The courts took a long time to wake up. Eventually they did act, but it took years rather than weeks or months, whereas already in the first year, the British courts were actively engaged in receiving complaints and acting upon them. The legal community, and I'm sorry to say this, but many of my friends in the legal academic community in the United States switched off. They didn't want to put their head above the parapet at a time when the United States plainly felt itself under attack and in which it was not politically convenient to speak out against what was already plainly a strong story of governmental abuse. Now, all of these factors, and I'm sure a great deal more, conspired to create for the administration a window of opportunity in which they could promote policies which in all other times would have been unacceptable.
Was it reinforced by the popular culture, do you think, or against the grain of the American way?
I think popular culture plainly has something to play in all of this. You know, I was engaged. One of the people that I spoke with the most was Diane Beaver. And in the course of...
She was the chief lawyer.
Diane Beaver was the staff judge advocate at Guantanamo, Lieutenant Colonel Diane Beaver. She was directly responsible as the lawyer for the combatant commander, Major General Mike Dunleavy. In the course of one of our early conversations, she mentioned to me 24 and Becker, which is what I wrote down on a piece of paper. I then went back to my hotel room. I typed out my notes, as I did to keep the ideas fresh in my mind, and 24 Becker didn't mean anything. So I typed it into the computer, I typed it into Google, I did a Google search, and it came back with, "Do you mean 24 Bauer?" I said, "Yes." And that was how I discovered the television show, the Fox TV show, 24. I had never watched it, I'd vaguely heard about it, but I really didn't know what it was about. And I stumbled accidentally in this way, revealing my gross ignorance of popular culture in the United States, one of the main sources of inspiration at Guantanamo. It turned out that the second series of 24 went to air on the 29th of October 2002. In other words, at exactly the time that these techniques were being promulgated at the top of the administration and were being discussed down at Guantanamo. And of course, what I discovered from Diane Beaver when I then went back to speak to her again, as she put it to me, 24 had many friends down at Guantanamo. It had many friends because what it portrayed, and you only need to watch the opening few minutes of the first episode of the second series, the guy being tortured, spilling the beans, the messages, torture works. That had a profound effect. And it was coupled, of course, with academic writings. One thinks of the writings of Professor Alan Dershowitz. Again, perhaps it was just a coincidence, but in August 2002, he wrote a book which essentially promoted the idea of institutionalizing torture. He claims he's not in favor of torture, but since torture is going to happen, let's make it transparent, let's make it accountable, let's have a decision-making process that puts it all above board. And for 2 months after August 2002, again, at exactly the same time as these techniques are being developed, Alan Dershowitz is going from studio to studio, from op-ed page to op-ed page, saying, let's institutionalize torture. And as Mike Gellis put it to me, that made his task of opposing the move to abuse very, very difficult.
It's fascinating to see in hindsight that the Harvard Law School was, shall we say, in the thick of this thing. Not only Alan Dershowitz, Jack Goldsmith had been Jim Haynes's special counsel. John Yoo went to the Harvard Law School. Jim Haynes went to the Harvard Law School. Philip Hyman at the Harvard Law School seemed to be egging the process on. Where was the elite school of the American legal profession?
It's a question that I've asked myself many times. I think one has to distinguish between each of these individuals. I mean, Mr. Haynes and Mr. Gonzalez, both Harvard Law School graduates, were obviously at the heart of the whole operation, deeply, deeply involved. And the material that has come out since my book appeared, the hearings that have been held in May, June, and July of 2008, have made clear his active and early role in pushing forward the agenda of abusive interrogation. This is not just an example of, you know, the lawyer discreetly operating in the background. He was deeply and directly involved. The others had involvement of a different kind. I mean, who knows whether Alan Dershowitz was aware of what was going on down at Guantanamo or elsewhere. I don't know. I certainly didn't discover any evidence that he did know. But of course, his writings were helpful to the administration that was pushing in this direction. In my view, they were deeply irresponsible writings. And I do wonder whether he turned his mind to the question, if you knew that your writings would have this effect, would you persist in going down that route? Jack Goldsmith was Jim Haynes' special counsel from September 2002 onwards. There are different narratives about the extent to which he knew. He was certainly down in Guantanamo in September 2002, accompanying Mr. Haynes and others, meeting Diane Beaver and others, apparently. He writes about that in his book. We don't know the full details of what, if anything, he was actually involved in or what he knew. Phil Hayman, I think, has a slightly different role. He authored a report with Juliette Kayyem, which essentially talked about the institutionalization of certain techniques of interrogation. But he's very careful in that report to make it clear he doesn't want to go down the institutionalization of torture, but only the institutionalization of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment. So it's a nuanced and different position from others. But of course, it was seized on by Jim Haynes as legitimating the direction that he had taken. This is a very troubling development, and I hope that there'll be full and frank discussion about it in order to really tease out who, in fact, was responsible. What's clear is the lawyers played a central role. As Jane Mayer has put it in her book, The Dark Side, but for the lawyers, this would not have happened.
I want to go back to the European and American perspectives on this thing, and let me just say, I don't want to let the UK off the hook. Tony Blair could have stopped that war in Iraq, and he didn't. The Brits have used a lot of these techniques and others against the Irish in Northern Ireland for years. So no blanket amnesties here. But what is the difference, do you find now, on both sides of the Atlantic around this blot?
Well, I'm acutely aware of the deep involvement in the British government in many of these issues. I argued a case some years back opposing the government's efforts to allow evidence that may have been obtained from torture at Guantanamo to be used in English proceedings. And we succeeded with our highest court, the Judicial Committee of the House of Lords, in stopping that dead in its tracks, and it hasn't come back since. I'm also acutely aware that there are proceedings right now pending in the English courts which raise the question of British complicity. And I've written an academic article a couple of years ago in a journal, the European Human Rights Law Review, raising the possibility that Mr. Blair himself or others in his government may have been complicit by turning a blind eye to information that would have indicated the United States was moving to abuse, particularly in the program known as Extraordinary Rendition. I think what's been interesting in the UK is that across the political spectrum, this has been received with abject horror. I think it's not just the United Kingdom, but the move to torture has, you know, very few adherents. The door has been kept very closed on that possible direction in the United Kingdom and across the political spectrum. There's the strongest possible opposition, of course, largely motivated by Britain's dire experience in Northern Ireland. I mean, Britain moved to use five techniques of interrogation for a short period in 1971, hooding, stress positions, these types of things, very similar to what was used down at Guantanamo. And the effect of that was soon seen to be catastrophic. It undermined morale of the soldiers involved in prosecuting a response strategy to terror. It most significantly didn't produce any useful information, and perhaps even more significantly, it created a recruiting tool, as was described to me very vividly by a lady who attended one of my book speaking tours in Belfast a few months back.
Really?
They used the information about the move to abuse to recruit people who otherwise would have been on the fence. And it probably extended, on some people's view, the conflict with the IRA by between 10 and 15 years. When you take abuse coupled with internment, coupled with Bloody Sunday, the whole effect was really catastrophic. And Jane Mayer writes, I hadn't been aware of this before, that is, in September 2001, very shortly after September the 11th, when the British came over to Washington, they sent a very clear message: don't go down the path of abuse. It does not work. And the administration didn't follow that encouragement.
There's a British historian of the French War in Algeria who sent exactly that message to Donald Rumsfeld and got a response, but it was a kiss-off. One wonders, I mean, might Tony Blair not have whispered this to George Bush early on? By the way, George, it doesn't work.
I don't think that was the sort of relationship they had. I mean, I've not been privy to any material between Tony Blair and George W. Bush on the issue of torture and abusive interrogations. But I have seen material that I should probably not have seen, including minutes of meetings between Bush and Blair in relation to the war in Iraq. And it's abundantly clear from that material that the relationship is one of deference on the part of the British Prime Minister. I mean, this is not a British Prime Minister who's going to read the Riot Act to his US President. This is not a British Prime Minister who's going to say to George W. Bush, look, actually, we don't think this is a good idea. Don't do it. We cannot be associated with this, and we will go public if you persist. You cannot count on us. It wasn't that sort of relationship. It was a sort of kowtowing, deferential relationship in which basically they were joined at the hip. And that is why it wouldn't surprise me in the least if in the coming period evidence emerges to show that Mr. Blair knowingly turned a blind eye to information showing seriously problematic actions by the U.S.
You spoke a few moments ago about an intention, perhaps, to create a legal black hole. What did you mean?
That expression was coined in an English Court of Appeal courtroom in November 2002 in a case called Abbasi. Abbasi was a British detainee at Guantanamo. I argued the case for Abbasi before the English court, and in their judgment, the court described the situation at Guantanamo, in which Geneva had no writ, in which there were allegations of abuse, as a legal black hole. And I think what those judges in the English Court of Appeal meant was a situation in which humans, human persons, are devoid of rights. They are cast into a wilderness in which their rights as an individual are removed in their entirety. And that, for the Court of Appeal, was unacceptable. That, for me, is unacceptable because that is precisely what the system of rules that the United States has done so much to put in place after the Second World War was intended to avoid. You know, it comes back to Spencer Tracy in Judgment at Nuremberg, the dignity of even a single human person is what our values are about. There are no legal black holes, and the moment you go down that route, you undermine the entirety of who it is we believe we are and what it is that we believe we're doing.
Was there somebody in that Pentagon, maybe including Donald Rumsfeld, who wanted, who had reflectively chosen to seek a legal black hole?
Well, I think I've answered that question in the affirmative in this way. I think there was a conscious decision to remove international legal constraints and U.S. legal constraints, after all, that's why Guantanamo is outside the United States, which would limit the ability of the administration to adopt new techniques of interrogation. The legal black hole was the removal of international constraints on interrogation as part of an ideological drive to increase executive power and remove the shackles of international laws. It has failed miserably, but I think that the responsibility goes right to the very top of the administration. I mean, we're talking Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld, Vice President Cheney, President Bush were deeply involved in each of these decisions, and they were aided and abetted in those decisions by their lawyers. And that, to my mind, is what is so deplorable and so un-American, that lawyers ultimately have a responsibility not just to give to their masters and to their clients the advice that is wanted, but to the system of rules and the system of justice as a whole. And they failed abominably in that effort.
Philippe Sands, you know, I read this book with tremendous excitement. I mean, this gets to the hair on the back of your neck. But all through it, we're saying, Spencer Tracy, where are you? From the, you know, that wonderful American voice at the end of Judgment at Nuremberg. He says specifically about the Nazis, and not to compare the crimes, but to compare the principles. He says about the Nazis, the lawyers who sanctioned and opened the door to this madness are responsible. They are criminals. Now what?
It's a remarkable piece. It's the verdict at the end of the film Judgment at Nuremberg. It's a sort of 5-minute piece. Every time I watch it, it sort of puts a lump in my throat. In particular, the bit where he says, the time will come in my own country when people say necessity justifies these types of actions in the name of national security. I mean, I'm paraphrasing him, but that's the gist of it. And of course, that's precisely what has happened. If you go back to Jim Haines' statement in June 2004, when he justifies the Guantanamo techniques of interrogation, he basically says, we faced a situation of necessity, we faced a situation of compelling national security need. And that is exactly what Spencer Tracy evoked. I tested the proposition, what is the responsibility of the lawyers, with a European judge and a European prosecutor. I needed a sort of reality check. Am I sort of way off beam here? The conventions, the torture convention, for example, describes participation and complicity in torture as a crime. And so I went off to see a European judge and a European prosecutor, both of whom have been involved in prosecuting international crime cases and torture cases. And they really didn't hesitate. They didn't mince words. They said that in their legal system, having regard to their international obligations, the torture convention, the Geneva conventions, they had no doubt that lawyers engaged along the lines that these facts appeared to disclose could have crossed a line into criminality. And that's why, coming back to our earlier conversation, these lawyers, I think, do face a very real threat of the tap on the shoulder if they travel to various parts of the world, and I'm sure they will exercise very real caution.
I'm fantasizing here. Wouldn't it be amazing if John McCain, of all people, who has a track record on torture, after all, embraced the cleansing of the American record as a campaign issue and said, we're going to get to the bottom of this, not perhaps by Truth and Reconciliation, perhaps by congressional investigation, presidential commission, perhaps by criminal prosecutions, but we're going to tell the story and we're going to get this out of our craw.
Well, I think that would be a wonderful thing. And I mean, obviously the man has it in him to do that. He has, until relatively recently, had an excellent record on the issue of torture. I deeply regret that he voted for the Military Commissions Act provisions, including those which gave or purported to give immunity from investigation in the United States, which opens, of course, the door to foreign investigation. But there's no reason why he can't do that. You know, Chris, these issues are not party political. The hero of my book, and there are a few heroes, actually. I don't want to single out one in particular, but I will mention one in particular, a man called Alberto Mora.
Yes, indeed.
Alberto Mora was the general counsel of the Navy, a Cuban-American, very much, you know, in the Republican administration, deeply committed to the Republican cause. And yet, when the materials came across his desk, he was so horrified. This is not what we do, he said. It was he who then confronted Jim Haines, and through Jim Haines,
the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, and said, we cannot do this, and if this doesn't stop, I will be forced to take certain actions. In Britain, this hasn't been party political, and I think one of the really distressing aspects of the past few weeks and months is the extent to which partisanship has taken over this type of issue. I felt it when I've appeared, when I've testified before House Judiciary and Senate Judiciary, that there is a partisanship, party partisanship, in relation to this issue, which suggests it's going to be very difficult for someone like John McCain to do that. I wish he would. I don't care which of the presidents does it or which of the presidential candidates do it. The reason it needs to be done is that I think we all benefit from the United States being back fighting for the from the front and leading from the front on promoting a system of values that I care passionately about, that many people I know care passionately about, because if the United States isn't doing it, it's not immediately clear who else is going to be doing it. And that doesn't matter whether it's a Republican administration or a Democratic administration. The United States needs to get its house in order to restore its position. I believe that can be done. I think that can be done pretty quickly. And, you know, renew its position.
Alberto Mora foresaw, among other things, many, many risks here. One, that this sort of abuse would leak and spread, as it did indeed to Abu Ghraib. Also, that it puts American troops at risk when they're captured. Also, that it blots the reputation of the country in a huge way. Measure the damage and imagine the ways that it might somehow, over years perhaps, be undone.
Well, I think the damage is very, very significant. I mean, I feel it going around the world. As I testified before the House Judiciary Committee, you know, I work as a barrister. I'm an English QC, a Queen's Counsel. I act for a lot of governments. I've had representatives of governments, foreign ministers, even a president, talk to me about John Yoo's memo on the redefinition of torture. It has spread all the way around the world. It has had an absolutely cancerous and appalling effect, A, on America's reputation, and B, on the efforts to give effect, enforce proper human rights standards. Now, I don't believe that there is outside of the United States the kind of virulent anti-Americanism that some people are suggesting. I think if the United States were to say, we are going to get our house in order, we're going to sort this out, we're going to get to the facts, we leave open how we deal with issues of responsibility, I think that would be a big thing. I think it would have a decisive influence and effect. But I think if they don't do that, we're going to be in Pinochet, IRA-style situations in which the thing festers for years and years and years, in which it is internally divisive in the United States. And most significantly, as a point you didn't mention, it's going to corrode the ability of the United States to be able to work effectively with its allies. You know, it is said, I haven't seen the documents, I can't establish it conclusively, that many of the United States' allies now will not hand over detainees in the conflict in Afghanistan, for example, to the United States. So concerned are they about the possibility of being then seen as complicit in abuse. So it's been deeply, deeply damaging.
Can it be undone?
I think it can be undone, absolutely. I've just described the ways in which it can be undone. I think we sort of learn in a historical experience that in order to undo this type of thing, there has to be a sort of bloodletting and a recognition of responsibility. And, you know, one of the things that I think has distressed me the most is that in my conversations with people at the top of the administration, I'm not talking about the Diane Beavers, the lawyer down at Guantanamo, or her boss, combatant commander, the head of interrogations, Major General Dunleavy, but the Doug Feiths, the General Myers, the Jim Haineses, I'm not picking up any sense of regret for the decisions that were taken or any sense of personal responsibility for having fallen into error. I think if I had heard from these people the kinds of arguments which said, look, cut us some slack, it was the anniversary of 9/11. We faced an intelligence spike, new attacks were coming. In the circumstances, we had a responsibility to protect the people of the United States, a fundamental responsibility of any government. And it turns out we fell into error, and we take responsibility for that. My reaction would have been completely different. I wouldn't have written this book. That is not a message I heard. And I think until that message is heard, it's going to be very difficult to clean it up.
Philippe Sands, it's a rippingly important, furious, enlightening, clear book. Let it inspire us all to do something. Thank you for the book. Thank you for the conversation.
Philippe Sands' book is Torture Team. Paul McCarthy and Sarah Archambault edited this conversation. Speak your piece on Guantanamo at our website, www.radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining us.